with us in this Bible study, Lord. I just thank you so much for him being here every week and him taking his time out of his schedule just to meet with us and to help us learn more about you, Lord. And we just thank you so much for this book that we're going through, Lord. And I thank you for all the things that it's teaching us about relationships and just our relationship with you, Lord. And we thank you so much for just for your great love for us and for just the way that you can show it to us through Scripture. And I just pray that you'll be with us during this time. For anybody else who's on their way over here, Lord, that you just get them here safely and quickly. And I just pray that you'll bless everyone for the rest of this day, whether we're just preparing for finals and writing papers or whatever else we have on our list of things to do, Lord. I just pray that you bless everyone through the things that they're doing today. So I just pray all these things in your son's name. Thanks.
We actually got a little bit into chapter 6, but the Song of Solomon is a very dynamic book in that the Shulamite and Solomon both grow and are transformed by their relationship, and they obviously love each other deeply, and their priorities and lifestyles are quite different. The queen's responsibility is to be around the palace, to be taking care of the gardens, to be concerned with the relationships with the other ladies in waiting and with the affairs of the court. And the king is a warrior and a man of prayer and is obviously called up to fight wars and to be gone for periods of time. And we've seen that dynamic, and we've seen how the king several times has come to draw his bride after him, longing for her companionship in dangerous places. And the time periods when he's gone correspond to time periods when we don't feel close to God, when we have no maybe conscious sense of the presence of God. And in chapter 5 we had a long season in this Shulamite's life when the king was gone, and then suddenly in the night he came knocking on the door, and she hesitated, by the time she got over her indecisiveness, he had gone. He was evidently on urgent business, and wanted her to jump right out of bed and put on her warm winter overcoat and come up in, evidently into whether in spiritual warfare probably or something by night, and he didn't have time to wait for her, which of course is a picture of God sometimes calling us to instant obedience, to immediate obedience, to dropping whatever we're doing to go do something that seems that's not convenient in our time scale. When he leaves, she panics, runs out in the street. This time the watchmen on the walls do not treat her kindly. They're very probably upset by her erratic behavior. They beat her and wounded her and took away her mantle, at which point she begins to realize that she's had yet another emotional overload, and she tells the daughters of Jerusalem one more time, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I'm sick with love." The daughters of Jerusalem are puzzled by this. They say, "Well, where is your beloved? What is your beloved? Who is this guy you keep telling us about, O fairest among women? Why do you come to us to ask us where your beloved is?" So she's kind of ruined her testimony, in other words. But she recaptures comes to her senses and gives this incredible testimony about her beloved to sort of recover the whole situation. "My beloved is all radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside springs of water, bathed in milk, fitly set. His cheeks are like beds of spices, yielding fragrance. His lips are lilies, distilling liquid myrrh. His arms are rounded gold, set with jewels. His body is ivory work encrusted with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns set upon bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His speech is most sweet. He is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. So she recaptures this and by faith gives this testimony about who her beloved is, really, based on her long experience, and realizes that she's gotten into a pity party and she's depressed because he's not there. But when she comes to her senses, she realizes that their relationship hasn't changed and gives this very beautiful description of her beloved, which totally turns around the daughters of Jerusalem, because they say, "Where has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Where has your beloved turned that we may seek him with you?" So instead of being doubting and skeptical and questioning the queen, the daughters of Jerusalem are now startled by this testimony. And she continues, the king has gone. She had panicked because he left suddenly and gone somewhere and she didn't know where. But now she says, and they want to know where he is, and she says, "My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to pasture his flock in the garden, to gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He pastures his flock among the lilies." So she says, by faith, she says, "My beloved hasn't left me. He's merely out doing the work that he does, taking care of the gardens, fighting spiritual battles. He's out taking care of his flock. This is what he does all the time. And by the way, he pastures his flock among the lilies," which was the very first question she wanted to know when she first met him, was, "Where do you pasture your flock?" So in the ensuing time, she has discovered where he pastures his flock, and so she's used to him as the chief shepherd, and she's now able to point others how to get to this kind of relationship. "He pastures his flock among the lilies." She was originally the one lily among the thorns, but now there are more than one lily. The lily among thorns would be the beautiful maidens, the committed Christian who loves God wholly and whose life is as different from the ordinary person as a lily is in a thorn bush. So that would be, that's the picture. "You are beautiful as Tirzah, my love. Come, this is the king speaking." So evidently he's back. "You are beautiful as Tirzah, my love. Comely as Jerusalem, terrible as an army with banners. Turn away your eyes from me, for they disturb me. Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have come down from the washing. All of them bear twins, and not one among them is bereaved." He said most of those things about her on previous times when he comes home. Every time he comes home, he's not only delighted to see his lover, but he sees new qualities in her. He sees that she's grown. And now, "Your cheeks are like the halves of a pomegranate behind your veil." So we have the first mention of a veil, which hides her beauty from the world and shows that she belongs exclusively to him. "Cheeks like the pomegranates. The fruit of the pomegranate is red, sweet juice, but it's all inside, what's in the leathery outer skin." So the inner beauty of our lives is what attracts the Lord, not our outward appearance. Then he notes there are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number. So evidently while he's gone, she's been busy discipling, taking other Christians that only know the Lord a little bit and showing them the secrets of the intimate love that she's learned from him. So this would be correspond to getting the nominal, lukewarm, half-hearted Christian excited about Jesus and excited about the new covenant and excited about serving God in the lover, beloved way of intimate love. If you want, you can think of the Song of Solomon as a study of discipleship. If you think of the New Testament way of studying discipleship, it's based on obedience. It's based on doing what Jesus says. It's like a little bit like being in boot camp or in the Marine Corps. Jesus says, do this, and you do that, and then you become his disciple. So he disciplines and trains you. If you think of the Song of Solomon as a book of discipleship, it's based on a totally different way of being discipled. This would be the discipline of love. This is learning how to love with purity and with obedience and how to avoid lovesickness. But the goal would be the same. The goal would be to be an obedient disciple of the Lord or an obedient, mature Christian. So the queen now has brought a number of other immature believers into the same understanding of the Lord that she has. And that's amazing to the king. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number. That would maybe suggest that she's been leading people to the Lord and she's been training them, and a good number of them have decided to move on into a life of full, wholehearted commitment to the Lord instead of just being nominal believers. But we talked very briefly about verse 9. My dove, my perfect one, is only one, the darling of her mother, flawless to her that bore her. So he says, the relationship that you and I have is unique, and you're still as important to me as you ever were, even though he has other relationships that are also intimate and personal. This is the kind of one of the paradox of how can Jesus love you totally and wholeheartedly and uniquely for who you are, and yet also have an intimate relationship with all other believers that would like that. Now, if this, we would call that adultery if it took place in a marriage relationship. If a man said, I want four wives and I'll love each one of them wholeheartedly, we'd say, no way, that doesn't work. You can't love more than one wife wholeheartedly with your whole self. So, but on the other hand, the church is the bride of Christ, and the bride of Christ is not one woman. The bride of Christ is millions of men, women, and children, and any one of us can have whatever degree of intimacy with God that we'd like. So if this is about intimacy, your intimate relationship with God is yours and uniquely yours. And when you share things about your relationship with God with other people, the rest of us learn from what you have experienced. That's how unique the love Jesus has for you is. And there are no clones and no copies. So the idea here would be that God would like all of us to have this intimacy with him that's pictured by the Shulamite. And accompanying that, gardens and fruitfulness and ministry and the quality of life. Because she started out being a sort of nobody, and now she has the stature of a queen. And she has this great, who is this who looks forth like the dawn, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, terrible as an army with banners? So this is a woman of great stature. A woman of great stature has dignity and poise and femininity, but has this great strength. It's awesome. Wouldn't want to tangle with her. But she's this would be the opposite of a wallflower who never expresses herself and has no opinions on anything and is totally passive. So this woman is a woman who everybody admires as a woman of great stature, a queen, a real queen, royal. And so, this is also, you could say, this is a classic picture of the church. Who is this who looks forth like the dawn, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, terrible as an army with banners? The church is supposed to be an army with banners. We're supposed to be formidable in the world. The world should tremble at the church. Jesus said, I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against my church. He's speaking offensively. I'm going to build my church, and the church will attack and overcome the very gates of hell. That's the kind of church I'm building. Great army. Honorary Christian soldiers sort of thing. Well, the church isn't that today, but that's what it's supposed to be. So the church is kind of, the church inwardly is a woman, but outwardly is the body of Christ. So that seen from the inside, that we are the bride of Christ gathered around the bridegroom. Seen from the outside, we're a formidable army. So there's kind of inverse. Is that all confusing? Now that she says, I went down to the nut orchard to look at the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vines had budded, whether the pomegranates were in bloom. Before I was aware, my fancy set me in a chariot beside my prince. I take that to mean that she is out doing one of her regular daily chores. Who knows where the king is? Attending the nut orchard, maybe in many years of lapse, and suddenly the chariot of her prince comes down and takes her away, which I would say might be like the rapture. Busy doing the work of the Lord, and the Lord comes along and takes you home and comes And the reason I think that is because in the following verse, she's missed. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you. Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance before two armies? That's very obscure in the Hebrew. If this is correct, and then the life of the king and queen continues right in heaven just as it was on earth, that our lives in heaven are extensions of our life on earth. But so I take chapter 7 as the extension of the king and the queen being together outside of time. And so the relationship is still there. How graceful are your feet in sandals, O queenly maiden. Now here's this beautiful love imagery that the king has for her. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Your navel is like a rounded bowl that never lacks wine, mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are pools in Heshbon by the gate of Beth Rabban. Your nose is like a tower of Lebanon overlooking Damascus. Your head crowns you like Carmel, and your flowing locks are like purple. A king is held captive in your tresses. You're overwhelmingly attractively and beautiful to me, and feminine and gracious, and he finds new beauty in her every time he sees her. How fair and pleasant you are, O loved one, delectable maiden. You are stately as the palm tree, and your breasts are like clusters. I say, I will climb the palm tree and lay hold of its branches. Oh, may your breasts be like clusters of the vine, and the scent of your breath like apples, and your kisses like the best wine that goes down smoothly, gliding over lips and teeth. So this is just the superlative language of love, of people that have been in love a long time and kind of need new words to express how much you care about one another. And beautiful Oriental imagery of love and no shame and all that. She says, verse 10, she replies, I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. Perfect security in his love. Now she's perfectly secure and comfortable in his love. Come, and now she says, come my beloved, let us go forth into the fields and lodge in the villages. Let us go out early in the vineyards and see whether the vines have budded, whether the grape blossoms have opened and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes give forth fragrance, and over our doors are all choice fruits, new as well as old, which I have laid up for you, O my beloved. This is interesting because early in the story, he had to come and coax her to come out outdoors. He was the one that had to coax her to come out, the winter's over, to come and look at the flowers are blooming, won't you come out and into the hills with me? And now it's turned around exactly. She's the one that says to him, come, my beloved, let's go out into the fields. So she's full of confidence and joy. She's the one that wants to go make love out in the forest. Whereas earlier, he was the one that coaxed her into that, and her fears wouldn't let her do things like that. Now she's the one that's totally comfortable and confident in who she is. So, and all this fruitfulness, all of this, man, the spices and the pomegranates and the mandrakes and the fruits, new as well as old, are the pictures of the fruit of the Holy Spirit. It's this lavish demonstration of love that produces love and joy and peace and gentleness in great measure. And having a life that's full of all of these fruits. And she's always importing new spices and growing new fruits for her beloved to enjoy. And creative love. I respond to the Lord with creative love. Oh, that you were like a brother to me that nursed at my mother's breast. If I met you outside, she says, I would kiss you and none would despise me. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother and into the chamber of her that conceived me. I would give you spiced wine to drink, the juice of my pomegranates. Oh, that his left hand were under my head and that his right hand embraced me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you stir not up nor awake in love until it please. What do you suppose she says? She says to him, oh, I wish you were a brother to me, and I wish that we had grown up together as brother and sister at our mother's breast. How does that fit life? You meet somebody and you fall in love with them, do you wish you'd known them for their whole life? Yeah. Do you wish you'd grown up together? Yeah, you do. You kind of would. To want your husband to be a brother, just adds another level of intimacy. You want to be your husband, your brother, friend, and wouldn't it have been fun to have grown up together? We didn't. We didn't grow up together. We didn't meet until we were 20. So you always, with your lover, you'd love to know everything there was to know about that person.
Also, you get a feeling of all those years missed.
Yeah, what did we miss during those years before we knew each other? Now that we have such a fantastic life, what would have been like it if we met sooner? I think that's the idea. Now, but once again, now we've got this. We've got this warning about lovesickness. What happens now? What's going on in her emotional life in chapter 8? Is she's thinking about him and enjoying him and enjoying her relationship with God and another mountaintop experience, another feeling of being overwhelmed with how great Jesus is, how wonderful God is, how exciting it is to know him. And then she says, she's pretty radical in wanting to make love, and she also wants to, she for some reason she'd like to take him to her mother's house again. We've talked about that before. Why would that be natural for a woman?
These are parents. It's a place of safety and.
Yeah, that's safety, and a woman is closer to her own mother and is bonded to her mother, and this is. So she'd like to take her beloved to mom's house, but that's a mother-in-law problem for him. That he's not nearly as fond of mother-in-law, but she might be a really nice lady. But that's the whole thing about it. For the cause of marriage, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. And the two shall become one flesh. Leaving and cleaving. Marriage, he's always talking about not leaving all other close ties behind and going and belonging to each other is what marriage is all about. You can't take your parents with you when you're walking down the aisle, and they can't go on the honeymoon with you. So, So, oh, that his left hand were under my head and that his right hand embraced me. I'm so weak and I'm so helpless and I just want to stay home and have him be here with me all day long. And is that, why is that love sickness? Well, you don't get any work done. You just get, you get starry-eyed and dreamy-eyed, and then you have to come back down to the world of reality eventually. And love is like that. So it's, again, when you get it, when you fall in love, you don't know what you're getting into. Go careful. Watch out for the dangers. And the dangers are two kind of ways you get lovesick in this book. The first way you get lovesick is to have some ecstatic, overwhelming, mountaintop experience of being overwhelmed with the love of God and being blown away by how great God is, and coming back down from Mount Hermon from the retreat and feeling higher than a kite and walking 5 feet off the ground until Monday, and then Monday crash and burn because you've got homework done and your roommate's irritable and your bills are overdue and crash and burn. So that would be number one kind of love sickness to watch out against. That the other kind of love sickness is to have a long period of time in which you don't feel close to God. Mm-hmm. When you feel like you're running on empty and God has left you and you're depressed and you're lonely and nothing's working out and there's nobody to talk to and nothing to do, and you pray and you don't get any answers, and you think, oh, God's forgotten me, and a long period of time goes by and you say, oh, I think I'll just dump this whole Christianity stuff. And that's that other form of lovesickness then. Which me, and the reality is the king is going to come back and you will regain that warm feeling, but you're going to have dry seasons. So that would be, so the lovesickness is all about being even keeled. Paul says to be instant in season and out of season, to be ready to serve God whether you feel like it or not, to be able to get the things done in front of you whether you're in a good mood or in a bad mood, to put your nose to the grindstone even though you love to be out hiking in the hills, or to be able to serve God even if you yourself are depressed or down. That would be to be even keeled in your Christian life and not get emotionally overloaded and stop and forget about faith. When you get emotionally overloaded, then you stop walking by faith. So that's the lovesickness. Make sense? Who is this coming up from the wilderness leaning on her beloved? I don't know who says that. The daughters of Jerusalem, probably. This is a time, there's a time interval that's gone by. This little verse stands alone. Who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? So let's imagine what's happening. Here we're in Jerusalem, and we look out across out over the desert, and lo, the maiden, the king and the queen are coming in out of the wilderness, and she's leaning on him. But what does that correspond with in real life? What does it do?
Support.
Support. If she's leaning on him for support, but what's the wilderness about? Why wilderness?
That's a dry spell.
A dry spell or a terrible spell. Maybe some suffering. Maybe some terrible calamity that makes you just cling to the Lord. And maybe it's, so do you have times in the wilderness? Yes, we do. Do you have times when things go really wrong in your life? Yes. Maybe somebody that you're close to dies or gets sick. A whole bunch of bad things happen can you cling to the Lord closer? Can you lean on him more? Well, yes, if you can, that's what then great good comes out of it. And the wilderness doesn't last forever. So yes, that's the... I think that's how you get cured of love sickness. You get cured of love sickness by suffering and hardship and trial, and by finding out that you can always lean on the arm of your beloved and he will never fail you, never, ever, ever. And the more you practice that, the more you're not bothered by the ups and downs of life. Christians who've been tortured and thrown in jail and suffered for their faith tend to be unperturbed by the things that get us down. Mm-hmm. Don't bother us. We get bothered by little things, sore toe. A B minus when it should have been a B. So, he says in verse 5, under the apple tree I awakened you. There your mother was in travail with you. There she who bore you was in travail. That's kind of archetypal. Under the apple tree I awakened you. There your mother was in travail with you. There she who bore you was in travail. Anybody want to hazard a guess?
Are they just back where she was born?
Like, yeah.
Is he now at the mother's house?
Yeah. Like, well, yeah, or God speaking to Adam. Or God speaking to the deepest level. I formed you in your mother's womb. I was there on the day you were born. How well do I know you? How much do I know about you? I know everything there is to know about you. Who assembled you? Who put your genes and chromosomes in place, and who got the embryo nurtured, and who was there when your mother brought you in the world? Who called you to belong to me? I think that's the voice of God speaking here to us. You think I don't understand you? You think that you can fool me? Do you think that I don't identify with your feelings and hurts and pains? And yeah, he does. She says, verse 6, this is my favorite verse in the whole Bible, whole of the song. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, and most vehement flame. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly scorned. Now let's go out into eternity, and we talk about we're into a love affair that's forever and ever and eternal, and this is a pledge between two lovers. And what is the pledge, and what's it about? First of all, set me as a seal upon your heart. A seal upon your arm. Now, what is that symbolism?
Give your heart to each other?
Yes, and not only your hearts. Set me as a seal upon your heart. We belong to each other. Let's pledge our pure love for one another from the heart. And also, a seal upon the arm.
Strength?
Yes?
Is that like the symbolism of today when we wear a ring around our finger?
Yeah. But the heart has to do with the affections, and the arm would signify actions. So you could say, you can tell somebody you love them with all your heart, but if your life isn't consistent with that, then that's hypocrisy. So she says, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. Now, the next verse is, for love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, a most vehement flame. Why should you pledge your love to Jesus with your whole heart and with your whole self? Why should the man and the woman give themselves so totally and so wholeheartedly to each other? What is so important about love? What is, why is love so important? The greatest of all these is love.
Well, without love, we have nothing.
You have nothing. How do you ever escape from death? Who's gonna get you through the door of death?
Jesus Christ.
Jesus is with His love. His love is gonna take you right through the gates of death, and because He's died in your behalf. And so then, love is strong as death. So if you don't love God with your whole heart and your whole mind and your whole life, then why should you hope to be delivered into eternal life? What about jealousy is as cruel as the grave? What's that about? About having false lovers. What happens if you get into spiritual adultery or literal adultery? What does that do?
It destroys you from inside.
Yeah, it destroys you. So this says, it's terribly important that you love God with your whole heart and your whole mind and your whole soul and all your might. That's the first and great commandments. And life is all about that, and it goes right on into eternity. And jealousy is as cruel as the grave. God's a jealous lover. That means He's a zealous lover. God hates anything in our lives that hurts us, that gets in the way of our relationship with Him. He's zealous. Like you're zealous for your children. If somebody tries to harm your kid, you can become very outraged in a hurry. So that's what God's like. He's zealous. God wants the absolute best for you, and He'll fight for the best for you. But if you're going to be unfaithful to God, which is spiritual adultery, then you can expect the cruelty of the grave. You can expect the penalty, the wages of sin, and pain and suffering and hardship and loss, which we see Christians buckling into all the time. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. What's that suggest? Suggests to me the flood of Noah. Billions of people drowned and eight people were saved. And eight people were saved by the love of God, and all of the waters of the flood that wiped out a whole world couldn't quench love. And the floods couldn't drown it. So God's love can take you through fire, as with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the burning fiery furnace, and it can take you through the flood, can take you through any trial that you're called on. So that this puts love up in the supreme place, and the pure love, not Hollywood romantic love, but the pure love of God is here now. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly scorned. What's that mean?
It's like something picking up his plan, trying to buy it, buy love.
Yeah, can you buy love? No. Dying of cancer and you're the richest man in the world and you say, I'll give $1 million, just cure my cancer. No, can't be done. And you go to somebody and you say, you're the most wonderful person in the, I will make you the happiest person in the world if you'll marry me, and I'll give you anything your heart's desire, and I've got lots of money, and I'll work for you, and I'll give you whatever you want. And she says, get lost, kid.
But even if she said, okay, she wouldn't be doing it for you, she'd be doing it for money.
Yep. So that works both ways then, doesn't it? Real love does not have a price on it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly scorned. All of us have a sense of what real love is, and all of us know when we're being bribed, manipulated, prostituted, somebody's wrong motives. Somebody's lonely and they need love, so they're willing to pay for it. Somebody wants a companionship, so they don't. It's not you they really care about. It's the fact that you can meet their needs. How many people get married out of need love? We're two needy people, so let's take care of each other. When there's no real self-giving love that wants the best for the other person. So there's this says that agape love that God has for us. Agape love always seeks the best interest of the beloved, no matter what price it costs you. You always want the best for your lover, your beloved, no matter what it costs you. You want their best interest. That real love gives whether you get anything back or not. Real love says, this hurts me, but I'm doing this for you, for your good. I have to give up something to do what's right for you. That's so totally contrary to the world's kind of love. This is a self-giving love. I see you. I know you. I know what kind of person you are. I know what your needs are. I'm going to meet your real needs to the end that you grow. I'm not going to manipulate. I don't care if you're not capable of giving back. That's fine. I'm giving no strings attached type love. There we have it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly scorned. So a genuine person will reject these counterfeit offers that aren't real love, that will have betrayal by them eventually.
Going back to the flashes part, do you think that's associated with the love or is it jealousy? It seems like
jealousy,
right?
Yeah. Jealousy is as cruel as the grave. Its flashes of fire. God is very jealous in that. Very, very, sometimes violent way. If something threatens you, if you're one of God's children and something threatens you and you need God's protection.
So it's like the flame that burns up everything that's not, like, I don't know.
Yes. Say that. What is that?
They try and double words like that are done for other loves or like built up.
The love of God is like a fire that will refine, that will burn up everything totally that it cannot refine. So the fire will refine and save everything that is worthy to be saved, but it'll be refined. And everything that's not worth saving will be burned up and consumed. So that's what our God is, a consuming fire. So that's the fire here of God's jealous love. He wants to burn all the garbage out of our lives and purify us, which takes trials to do, so that our motives are right and our love is pure. And then the garbage in our lives, it gets just burned up and thrown and done away with. So yes, that's the strong, pretty strong, huh?
Yeah. It's so cool because just fire, you know, needs to have fuel or something to burn, you know?
Yeah,
like, fire. I like the idea that it just reduces, like you can't just have the fire and then as soon as you run out of things to put in it, then
yeah.
It goes away, you know?
Yeah. But fire is just, the fire is this dual symbol. Fire is warmth and fellowship and love and energy and all the good things in life that come with that blazing sunshine out there that's burning fire. But fire also consumes. And hell is the backside of love. The fires of hell are what happens when you turn God's love off. You're denied any love from God because you didn't want to be loved by God. And he says, okay, I'll take away all my love, and then you get hell.
Yeah.
And that's fire. It's a fire. But for us, it's the fire is warmth and joy and love and it purifies. So those are the two symbols. We have a little sister, the queen says to the king. And she has no breasts. What should we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build her upon her a battlement of silver. But if she was a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers, then I was in his eyes as one brings peace. This sounds to me like two parents, two wise parents, spiritually speaking now, that have a little sister or a little daughter, and this little daughter doesn't have any, her breasts are not developed. How can we get her married when she's a little older? Who will want to marry her? She isn't attractive. Well, this was, of course, the state that the Shulamite maiden was in when she came in off the desert, sunburned and not very attractive. And immediately the king undertook to give her extra endowments and to build her into the woman that she should be. So the king and the queen say, to solve this problem with their little sister, if she is a wall, we will build upon her a battlement of silver. If she is a door, we will encircle her with boards of cedar. What does this woman have going for her, this little sister? Does she have any, what quality does she have that we can build on already? Well, she's a wall. She separated herself from the world. Let's make her into a big tower, a great tower of strength. If she is a door, if there's an entrance for the word into her life, then we will enclose her with boards of cedar. We'll cedar humanity again. We'll make her into a great and wonderful woman of God. And that's how I interpret that. In other words, spiritually, older, more mature Christians are always helping younger, less mature Christians. What happens when you meet a younger, immature Christian that's growing, that's very nice, you like them and they're part of the body of Christ, and you see their strengths and weaknesses? Well, you pray for them. You pray for them particularly in the areas where they have promise. And then God hears and answers, and the queen says, I was a wall and my breasts were like towers. So the queen sort of reminisces on the fact that she started out as a nobody and now she's the queen. So that would be, when you meet young, immature Christians, remember what they're going to be. And you can have a role in helping them grow by praying for them, and as parents would pray, or as older brothers and sisters. We all have that responsibility with new Christians. Pray for one another. Because we all start out as losers, and we all end up as royal sons and daughters. And how I read this. Now we get this little section here in which the queen speaks. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He let out the vineyard to keepers. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. My vineyard, she says, my very own, is for myself. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000 and the keepers of the fruit 200. In other words, at the beginning of the story, remember, she didn't have her own vineyard. She longed for her own vineyard. She worked for her brothers. Her brothers treated her poorly. It was in her heart's desire that she should one day have a vineyard, which means a ministry of your own. Now she has her own ministry. And not only that, but she looks at Solomon's thousands of vineyards, and she says, I am absolutely delighted with the vineyard God gave me. I don't envy the vineyard, anybody else's vineyards. This is my vineyard. This is my ministry and my life and my place in the family of God. And so I don't envy people that have other vineyards, because this vineyard is the result of the love between the king and I. So that is contentment in the life that God has given you. And you don't have to be jealous or envious of the fact that other people have what look like larger vineyards or different ministries or different callings. She's got what her heart longed for in the very beginning. This is what she longed for. Her own place and her own, she wanted to be in his flock, and she wanted her own vineyard, and she wanted her own freedom and her own individuality. She has that bountifully now. In fact, O you who dwell in the gardens, she says, it's the king who dwells in the gardens. My companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it. So she says, she longs for the king to come and visit the garden. But now there's many gardens, and the king visits many gardens, and she's not, that's all right. Make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag upon the mountains of spices. Years and years later, in this relationship, what is it that she likes the best about the king? He's a gazelle and a stag on the mountains of spices. Resurrection life. Vitality, freshness and newness. Every time he comes back, he's leaping on the mountains like a stag or a gazelle, full of fresh new life and spices. So the Christian life never gets dull, and it never gets old, and there's always some new adventure. And that's what's exciting about Jesus. Is that okay? Is that sort of kind of fit? Now, Psalm 45. The reason for Psalm 45 is that it, in a strange way, it goes along with Song of Solomon. This is a love song. It's a maskil. A maskil is a teaching psalm. It's designed to teach. And it's written by the sons of Korah, and the sons of Korah were branches of the Levitical priesthood who sang in the temple choir. And in this psalm, God is the king. My heart overflows with a goodly theme, says the psalmist. I address my verses to the king. My tongue is like the pen of a ready scribe. So the psalmist is all too eager to praise the king. And he says to the king, you are the fairest of the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. Well, now that sounds like the Song of Solomon. And who is it that's being praised here? It's the Son of God, the fairest of 10,000 of the fair. You are the fairest of the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore, God, your God has blessed you forever. That sounds like Hebrew. So that's about Jesus. Gird your sword upon your thigh, O mighty one, in your glory and majesty. In your majesty, ride forth victoriously for the cause of truth and to defend the right. Let your right hand teach you dread deeds. Your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies. The peoples fall under you. So here's the psalmist is calling out to Jesus to put on his armor and his sword and to conquer his enemies and to take the earth back. Ride forth in victory, O King. Verse 6. Your divine throne endures forever and ever. That's it, quoted in Hebrews 1 concerning Jesus. In Hebrews 1:8, that speaks of Jesus. Your divine throne, O God, endures forever and ever. That's Jesus. Your royal scepter is a scepter of equity. That means fairness and justice. You love righteousness and you hate wickedness. Therefore God the Father, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your fellows, above your comrades, or your brothers. We're all the brothers. So there, so far, that's Jesus. Your robes are all fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. Well, that's Song of Solomon imagery. From ivory palaces, stringed instruments make you glad. Daughters of kings are among your ladies of honor, and at your right hand stands the queen in gold of Ophir. Oh. If this is really... So far, this is absolutely clearly Jesus, but now there's something added here. There's a queen in the royal palace. Who could that be? The second part of the psalm is addressed to the queen. Hear, O daughter, consider and incline your ear. Forget your people and your father's house, and the king will desire your beauty. Since he is your lord, bow to him. The people of Tyre will sue your favor with gifts, the richest of the people with all kinds of wealth. The princess is decked in her chamber with gold-woven robes, and many colored robes she is led to the king, and her bridesmaids, her escort in her train. With joy and gladness they are led along as they enter the palace of the king. Who's this woman? It's us, the church. Instead of your fathers shall be your sons. You will make them princes in all the earth. I will cause your name to be celebrated in all generations. Therefore the peoples will praise you forever and ever. Now that's an interesting psalm. Because in the Old Testament, Israel was the wife of Jehovah. But Israel never shaped up, and she was usually a pretty unfaithful wife. In the New Testament, Jesus is unmarried, but he takes a virgin bride, and the engagement is now going on, and there's a coming wedding feast, and we are the bride. Well, he's not going to marry one literal woman then, and he's not going to let... Some woman wrote me the other day, and she says, "Will do you think Jesus is going to literally marry every one of us?" I said, "No, it's a metaphor. It's a figure of speech." And she wrote me back immediately and said, "Oh, what a relief." but the idea then, the idea of this picture of marriage would be intimacy with Jesus. Remember, the New Testament says we rule and reign with Jesus, that he shares the throne with us, that we have this very, very high responsibility that we judge the angels and we judge the world, and here we are. And look at the honor that's given to us with our golden robes and all of the palace paying attention to this beautiful queen with gold revoke here. That's us, queenly maiden. So the church is the queen of heaven, not the Virgin Mary. And this is us in this poetry the love song from Psalm 42. So that very much parallels Song of Solomon. Okay, does everybody see that? Strange.
Yeah.
It's unusual. Nobody ever talks about this sort of thing. Now, who was hopelessly confused or upset or have a question or comment?
I think that woman doesn't... I smile because Jesus also said that there will not be any marrying or giving in marriage at the resurrection.
Yep. That's right. So there's no marriage in heaven. So marriage is that exists in this lifetime gives us a picture of the intimacy that's talked about here. But this is not a literal marriage. But it's got plenty of intimacy in it, doesn't it? Plenty of love and plenty of masculinity and femininity. It means there'll be men and women in heaven, not just neutered unisex people. Well, I mean, that's an older view.
It's like you're having you have mouths in heaven, even though like you can eat, but eating isn't something, you know.
Yeah.
It just gets kind of superseded by something better, you know.
Yeah.
I thought it was cool how, just going back to the part where the king was talking about being at the wife's birth. That was really interesting. Like, and then thinking about how that's the way actually what, you know, he is marrying the church and he was at, you know, its birth and founded it. And gave it all this good thing, gave it all the good things, put the, you know, silver on the wall. And
the first woman, Eve, was taken from the side of Adam. And so God created Adam, Eve, and then when there was no counterpart found for Adam after Adam named all the animals, he put Adam into a deep sleep and took the woman, took out from the side of Adam, Eve, and formed. And the word there, the Hebrew word, is artistically created this woman to be a counterpart to the man, to be an adequate partner. And Adam was delighted. He said, "Here at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, Isha, because she was taken out of man, Ish." That's the first Eve. Now, who is the second Eve? Where does the second Eve come from?
Is it the church?
Yes. Where does the church come from?
Jesus.
The wounded side of Jesus, pierced with a spear. Blood-bought church has come by, in the piercing of the side of Jesus, the church is taken out. So the church is the second Eve. Okay? Then,
and Jesus is the second Adam.
And Jesus is the second Adam.
As one is.
So he's the head of a whole new race. Just as Adam and Eve were the head of the earlier fallen race, Jesus as the head of a whole new.
As sin entered the world through one man, so the world will be redeemed through one man.
Yeah, so the world will be redeemed through this one man, Jesus, yes. So we have all these pictures of our intimacy with Jesus and our new humanity and our being in a new family and our being cut off from Adam and our being made new in Jesus and blood bought and born again. All those are intimate pictures of a new family relationship and new people. That's why, and so that's why all this imagery of love and intimacy and family and the purity and all this, is the holiness is obvious through it all. And you can see that right away, you see how defiled the world is in all of its views of love and family, and how very much different is this biblical idea of love and relationships and plenty of intimacy and plenty of depth. Right? Okay. Great book. Our Father, thank you for this, the mysterious wonder of the Song of Solomon and Psalm 45 and all of the. This is very provocative, and in our culture we don't stop and think about this very much, and in our churches this is kind of neglected truth, that we are the sons and daughters of Jesus. And we're taken out of the old Adam and we're in the new Adam and we're really totally new. And this calls forth, asks of us that we should be totally new in heart and deed and action, and that we should break free from the ways of the world that we inherited from Adam and exercise the liberty of faith and be the new men and women that will one day be the intimate bride of Christ. It's a tall order that you should prepare us to be seated at the right hand of God with Jesus and to rule and reign with him. That's just a staggeringly impossible tall order, but we know that's what you've determined for all of us. Please help us with the day-to-day struggles of boredom and loneliness and guilt and fear and anxiety and pressures and stress and emotional overload and all of the daily struggles. Please help us to keep leaning on you and crying out to you and faithful to you. Please just continue to burn away all the trash and purify our hearts and help us to understand true love, that true self-giving love that Jesus asks us to love each other with. And thanks for our fellowship, our time together, and just our friendships, these wonderful relationships in this room. that are destined for this life and eternity. In the name of Jesus. Thank you all. This is the last Saturday for now, unless somebody wants to put a